From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Whether you feel all that familiar or not, you've seen Hieronymus Bosch's paintings before. They're more than 500 years old, and they're out of this world. Bird monsters with helmets, a pig dressed like a nun, and the strangest hybrid creatures you've ever seen. They're just freaky, and you've got to wonder what was going on with this man. Well, the fact is, we don't know all that much. He lived in the 15th century, and what we do know isn't all that interesting. Bosch was kind of ordinary, a devoted husband, a churchgoer, stayed close to home. We do know this, though. He had an amazing imagination. The art historian Gary Schwartz says what made Bosch different, even unique for his time, was that in his paintings, he allowed himself to be free. Today in the program, we're talking about Hieronymus Bosch and what his fantastic creatures tell us about his world. After the news.
Hey there, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. If you enjoy the show, we'd appreciate it if you did us a little favor. Find us on the iTunes store and leave us a review. Let us know what you think. It's valuable feedback for us, and frankly, the more reviews we have, the more listeners we can attract. Thanks in advance. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The art historian Gary Schwartz says it was inevitable. As times passed, people's impressions of the work of Hieronymus Bosch changed. He says it's like the telephone game, where one phrase gets more and more twisted as it gets told and then retold and then retold. So the fantastical hybrid creatures and monsters and strange vessels Bosch created in the 15th century, the ones that depicted a surreal heaven and a terrifying hell, they took on a different meaning. Bosch came to be seen as a surrealist painter, an eccentric, an outsider. But Schwartz says he wasn't really any of those things. He was very much like the painters of his day in some ways. He used images to express something. But here's why, maybe at least, we still remember Bosch some 500 years now after his death. It's because, Schwartz says, he invented his own images. He was trying to engage the audience by baffling them. So he created these visual riddles, a pig dressed like a nun, a fish with the legs of a horse. There were beaks and backsides and helmets. Today in the program, we're talking about the mysterious painter who died 500 years ago. Gary Schwartz is our guest throughout the hour. Schwartz is an art historian who lives in the Netherlands. His work focuses on Dutch artists of the 17th century. He's written two books about Hieronymus Bosch. His latest is called Hieronymus Bosch, The Road to Heaven and Hell, and he's joining us today from a studio in Amsterdam. And Gary Schwartz, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
What a pleasure to be here, Doug. Thanks so much for giving me this opportunity to talk about Bosch and my book.
Good. I wanted to, I guess, begin with, so you were, born and raised, or at least born in Brooklyn, moved to the Netherlands quite a while ago. Mm-hmm. What was it that took you there?
Well, if you were here, I could just turn around and show you the place. And I think that it sometimes surprises me that not all Americans move here. It's a wonderful place to live.
Was art part of it? Was Bosch in any way part of it?
I came over as an art historian. I had finished my studies at Johns Hopkins and came over to work on a dissertation. So art was very much part of it. Yeah. But not Bosch. I was working on 17th century art, which is still my main focus.
Right. How do you describe your... And we'll get into this, obviously, in some detail, but just in sort of maybe a general way, how do you describe your reaction to Bosch's paintings when you first started paying attention to them?
Well, we all have the same reaction. We see him first on posters and T-shirts and billboards, and even in movies. George Lucas loved Bosch and used some of his creatures for Star Wars. So he's introduced actually as a weirdo,
yeah.
And it takes a little discipline, art historical discipline, to phase that out and to look at him as an artist of the past and try to figure out what he was about.
Do you think in some ways that's what this latest book is about, is trying to sort of clarify that he wasn't this weirdo. In some ways, he was kind of ordinary. Not ordinary in maybe some of the images he created, but he had a kind of an ordinary life.
He was a very conventional guy. He went into the family business, which was a painting studio that had been going for 50 years before he was born. He lived on the same square in this town of Dimbolce for his entire life. He married a lady to whom he was faithful. He didn't father any children out of wedlock the way so many of his contemporaries were wont to do. And he was a member of a very respectable church society, which we can talk about in a while. It's really very important in his life. So it's really strange. That makes him all the stranger to think that this man who had such a conventional life was capable of creating such unconventional art.
Yeah. Well, we'll dig into the images here in a moment. I wanted to ask you, there's been a lot of scholarship, you point out in your book, and kind of a lot of debate, various books with various competing ideas. What are the general ideas about Bosch? What's the debate been over time, do you think?
Right now, everyone is more or less in agreement with the basic attitude I took, and that is that Bosch was a good Catholic, not at odds with tradition, and that his art has to be seen in that light. But that hasn't always been the case, and there will always be people who disagree, who say that it's no accident that it looks so different. It really is different and reflects a different set of values, a different context than that of the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
The foremost of these the scholars who took that tack was a German art historian named Wilhelm Frenger. And Frenger wrote a book which came out in English under the title The Millennium of Hieronymus Bosch. And that millennium was the great triptych of the Garden of Earthly Delights. He said that it was that it was in praise of the free spirit, of the free life, of a life free of shame, free of sin. So that was a very attractive idea to a lot of people. Henry Miller wrote a book called Hieronymus Bosch and the Apples of Big Sur and the Apples of Hieronymus Bosch, in which he embraced this idea. So it went into popular culture. And art historians have been spending decades combating this idea. Frenger became a kind of a name of anathema to ridicule, which isn't entirely fair.
Yeah,
that's one of the issues that's involved. And another is the question of the authorship of the works attributed to him. Yeah. And in that, there is still tremendous variety of opinions.
This idea of the impression of the Garden of Earthly Delights, this idea that you were talking about, was that there was some idea that Bosch had this, like people could wander around naked and they could be free, and it was this free, but the concept that he was getting at, and we can sort of get back to this a little bit later, wasn't exactly that. But that was the impression that stuck for a while, I suppose.
Well, he does show the people in the central panel of the Garden of Earthly Delights walking around naked and not seeming to be ashamed of it. Yeah. But Frenger said was that it was a glorification of that life and that it was the aim of a body called the Brothers and Sisters of the Free Spirit. Well, there isn't any evidence that this body existed in Bosch's time. And so I speak as a member of the art historical community, have been at pains to dispute this. But it did make a mark earlier in the 15th century, in the century in which Bosch was born. There were trials accusing heretics of belonging to a group like that. Frenger's idea was that when you persecuted people who believed in this free spirit, they would go underground, and so they were able to continue doing their nefarious work without having emerged into the documentation.
We'll come back to that, because I want to spend a little bit more time with that, with the Garden of Earthly Delight. But let's talk about his name. Mm. I don't know how are we supposed to pronounce it, and just talk about how he, because that wasn't exactly his name. It's the name he put on, came to put on paintings, but just clear that up for us, if you would.
Okay. The two names by which he is known in English and Dutch are both totally anachronistic and wrong.
Yeah.
Hieronymus Bosch is a name which was only used after his death in the number of prints after his work. The spelling Hieronymus, that is used for Hieronymus, was never used by him. His name was Hieronymus with Jhaeronymus. So he signed with that name. His name in the streets and in the family was Jun. The Dutch called him Jeroen, which is only a 20th century form of his name. And his last name is pronounced Bos. The CH is silent in Dutch. So he's Hieronymus Bos.
You say that he began signing his paintings Hieronymus Bos as a way of kind of fashioning his own artistic identity. Explain that. He wanted to, what, set himself apart from his family, connect himself to his hometown in some way?
Doug, I told that short version of the name. I should have started by saying that his family name was Van Aken.
Yeah.
His family came from the German town of Aachen around the year 1400, and they took that name, their origins as the family name. So he used the name Bosch or Bos only when he began signing his works. He was an artist's name, a nom d'artiste, a brush name. And he used it, apparently, to identify himself as strongly as he could with the town where he worked, which is Den Bosch. And my feeling is that he did this because as his work became more and more famous throughout Europe, people who thought of it as the work of an artist named Hieronymus van Aken would have looked for him in the German town of Aachen. So he wanted to make sure that people could locate him at his right address.
Let's talk about Den Bosch. I think this is the. This seems.
Have you ever been there?
No,
Doug?
No,
oh,
never.
Well, you have a treat in store for you.
It's about an hour south of Amsterdam by train. I read this morning. I guess the thing that was crucial for Bosch's time was that it was a monastic city. It was deeply religious, I guess.
Yes. About one of every 20 inhabitants of the town belonged to a monastery or a convent, which was a very high percentage, even in Catholic Europe of the time. And it was full of processions, of religious observances, of confraternities to which regular citizens could belong. You didn't always have to be a priest or a monk or a nun in order to participate in organizational religious life. And he did very, very strongly.
So which sort of gets us to the basics. What is it that we do know about Bosch, about Bosch?
It's really only about an average of one document for every year of his life. So you have to be very careful about making any positive statements or any negative statements. It isn't, you can't say that he didn't do this or that. The adage among scholars is absence of proof is not proof of absence.
Right.
However, there are absent documents, which I think are important, and that is that He was never arrears in taxes. Mm-hmm. He was never called in front of the sheriff. The church never called him in to account for his doings. He got along well with his family. He was respected by this fraternity that he belonged to. And, you know, if there had been problems in his life of any of those sorts, those were likely to have turned up, because that kind of documentation enters the record much more quickly than just staying at home and being a regular guy.
Yeah. It seemed to me it was a little like Shakespeare, in the sense that we have these public documents, we have some details about his life, but there's some disputes about all of that. Mostly we have the plays in Shakespeare's case, and then the paintings and the drawings in Bulse's case. But I guess a lot of speculation over the years about what he was like and who he was.
There's nothing but speculation.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to say. Almost anything that anyone says about Bosch has been contested by others, and not just people off the street, but scholars with real reputations and backgrounds.
Yeah. He was a dedicated husband. We know that, or have a sense of that anyway. We speculate, I guess. Got along with his family, we think. Was pretty well respected in the town, as you say. Had money, but it was probably his wife's money, not his. I guess there's some sense that he didn't make a whole lot of money off his paintings himself.
The amounts that we know him to have received are indeed not high. But he was taxed at a rate that was applied to the top few percent of the inhabitants of Dombos. So he was a wealthy man in terms of his standing. Indeed, you could say, as has always been said, that it was mostly his wife's money. I'm not completely sure about that. I think that those fortunes were kept separately. When someone died, the goods were split between the families of the husband and the wife. So I think he got along pretty well.
Here's a question that comes from Beth, and we can sort of dig into this a little bit later as well, but it does raise this question of this issue of him being misunderstood. Beth writes, I once read that Bosch's images, in particular the Garden of Earthly Delights, were inspired by his being a member of a sex cult, the Brethren of the Free Spirit, she says. What do you make of that and that impression? Because that's out there.
Yes, that is the theory of Wilhelm Frenger. And that was the theme of his book, The Millennium of Hieronymus Bosch, that became the most popular book on the artist for years and years. And as I said, it's the theory that everyone loves to hate. So that all of the traditional art historians in the business are at pains to dispute this.
He was a cleric. Is that the way to put it? I mean, he wasn't an ordained priest, but he was a cleric.
Yes. Now, we know this because he was a member of a society that was not secret, but was very exclusive, and those were the Brothers of Our Lady of Dombos, of Our Dear Lady. And to be a member of the inner group, there were thousands of members. You could sign up for this, and anywhere in Europe you could become an outside member. But at the core, there were the sworn brothers, the made men. Mm-hmm. Those had to be either a priest or monk, thus an ordained religious in the Catholic hierarchy, or you could be a holder of the minor orders, and there were four of those, and they were usually conveyed all at the same time. If you were in the minor orders, you did wear a tonsure, so you shaved your head the way a monk would. You could be married, but as a member of this brotherhood, you were expected to live the religious life You had to go to Mass 2 or 3 times a week. You had to participate in church services and holidays during the year. And you had to live a respectable Catholic life.
Which raises the question, and I wonder if you've thought about this, does that, I mean, this question of whether or not in some way Bolth was just another religious zealot trying to, you know, terrify the credulous or the faithful into submission. I mean, should that in some way diminish our view of his art if he was just trying to sort of make these religious points?
He was not a zealot. I disagree with that qualification. He was, okay, look, a painter, an artist working for the church, as so many of his paintings were made, was an interpreter of churchly truth for the viewer, many of whom were illiterate. He took his instruction and values from the priests and the learned scholars in the church. And he did his best to bring across their messages in a way that would be attractive to, acceptable to, and understandable to a larger group of the uninitiated. So I don't see this as zealotry. It's a real service that he was delivering to his fellow believers.
You say the driving feature of his work, and maybe his artistic life, was this obviously, this really vivid imagination. And I wanted to talk about that because I suppose all painters have imagination. But what seems to have made Bosch unique for his time was that, as you put it, he gave free rein to his imagination. Mm. That seems unique. Would you talk about that?
I think that to do partly with where he lived. He didn't live in Antwerp or in Ghent or Bruges or Brussels, which were major centers in which he was surrounded by artists who would all be interpreting the great Flemish tradition coming from Jan van Eyck and Rogier van der Weyden. He had a field more or less to himself. He was the head, the chief honcho of the family of painters in the city. So he was free to set his own terms. There was no one who's going to be comparing what he did with the tradition around him. But having said that, it really is a psychological and professional feat to be able to take that degree of freedom and to work on it throughout an artistic career and create hundreds of images that no one had ever seen before, just dredging them up from your imagination. I think he was also giving form to a strain in medieval piety that has to do with books pretending to recount visits to the underworld. Of course, everybody knows Dante's Divine Comedy, but not everyone knew that in his town, and it was less famous than some other more popular books, such as The Vision of Tundale, an 11th century Irish monk who said that he went to hell and heaven and came back. And a lot of the images in Bosch are visualizations of descriptions that Tundale came up with when he returned to life after being taken through the underworld. So there is a lot of visual originality in Bosch, but it isn't all conceptual originality. These were the kinds of things that people were writing and talking about in his time and for centuries before.
One of the things you said was that it was typical of the time to sort of get people to, I guess, obey the rules of the church. You say the best way was to instill fear. Was that what Bosch was doing? I mean, those terrifying images of hell. We'll get to the hybrid creatures when we get back from the break here in a moment. But was he trying to scare people in some ways? Yeah.
Yes, I think he was. But he was doing it in the way of a horror film. You know, you sit through and you're terrified, but you're enjoying it at the same time. And it makes its point without freaking you out completely.
Gary Schwartz is with us. He's an art historian, author of the book about the life and work of Hieronymus Bosch. It's called The Hieronymus Bosch, The Road to Heaven and Hell. And we need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about the Dutch artist Hieronymus Bosch, Hieronymus Bosch. You've seen his paintings, even if they don't come to mind right now. The Garden of Earthly Delights is one that paints this surreal and kind of terrifying image of heaven and hell. And if you look at the weird hybrid creatures he painted, fish heads on tops of horse bodies and human bodies and bird heads, you'd swear that he was on drugs. And there have been questions about whether these were hallucinations or alcoholic nightmares. We don't know a lot about Bosch, but Gary Schwartz, the art historian, is joining us to talk about what we do know and what we make of the images in his paintings. He's joining us from a studio in Amsterdam. He's the author of a book about the life and work of Bosch, Hieronymus Bosch, The Road to Heaven and Hell. What about that idea that he may have been on drugs, or he may have been afflicted with some strange disease or something like that, or he was an alcoholic. I mean, you've heard those as well, of course.
Hmm. Well, I was on the lookout for any kind of hints in that direction, and I did find some things that intrigued me. It had to do with hallucinations, not of his own, but of mental patients or sufferers from a particular disease that caused hallucinations. And the homes at which these people were treated were just a few blocks away from where he lived. The sickness that led to hallucinations is called St. Anthony's Fire. It's identified now as a form of ergotism, a disease that takes place when you eat a kind of rye flour that had been contaminated. It had terrible symptoms. You lost limbs, but it was also known for causing weird visions. Next to the home for the patients of St. Anthony's Fire was an institution for the mentally unstable, the first of its kind in the Northern Netherlands. And one of the founders of it was the grandfather and also the guardian of Bosch's wife, Aleid van der Meervenne. So these kinds of sufferers from hallucinations were within arm's reach of him. He was very close. And I don't see why he would not have made use of the kinds of things that they were saying they were seeing in his art. But this is a far cry from the assumption that he himself was a sufferer or a delusionary. My own feeling, and this applies also to things that are said about Vincent van Gogh, is that mental disease is not something that enables you to create original art. It's something that disables you. You have to get over it in order to be able to do the kind of disciplined, dedicated work that's obvious in the work of these artists. So if they had these kinds of visions, they wouldn't have been working on them at the time they had them. The things that you work with as material when you're an artist.
Mm. I should mention, by the way, to our listeners that head on over to our Facebook page, the Radio West Facebook page. We're sharing some of the images in like super high resolution.
Oh, terrific!
Yeah, and so if you want, Gary Schwartz, you can refer to particular images, and we'll get them and put them up because people really need to see them. That it brings them obviously the conversation to life. I do want to talk about the hybrids. How, because this is one thing you write. You say that he had a penchant for innovation in terms of his iconography. The hybrids that he created, and maybe you could explain some of them, even describe some of them. Was this new? Was this original for Bosch?
No, it wasn't original with him. He was able to make use of traditions in, for example, the depictions of the Last Judgment by earlier artists who conjured up images of demons, devils, monsters, animals with claws and with beaks to peck you and to rip you apart. So that in itself was not an invention of Bosch's. But he seemed to ask himself every time he sat down to work, how can I do this in a way that will look very real and yet be obviously non-existing? It was... Well, here I have the one in front of me from the right wing of the Garden of Delights. There is a famous detail of a creature with a bird's beak, but with arms and talons, legs, sitting on a chair. He's on the right side of the hell panel, eating a human that has birds flying out of his ass in a cloud of smoke.
Right.
And from his own ass, he is ejecting creatures who fall into a bubble that goes down into the depths. Now, in fact, that image is really close to one of the visions that Tondalus said that he had when in the 11th century he went down into hell. And he says that there was a creature really more amazing than all of the other creatures he'd ever seen, that it did have a sharp beak and that it did ingest souls, damned souls, and did eject them and put them out into the depths of cold, where they would be revitalized and sent back to be eaten again. So it was Bosch's job, he saw, as he saw it, to make a creature of that kind look like it really could exist and to impress the viewer with the idea that if they did go to hell, they would be treated in this horrible way.
You mentioned asses. Why are there so many backsides in his images? There are tons of them. I'm noticing, and I have to say they're kind of, they seem like they would, I mean, to us, I guess, and maybe I'm being juvenile, they seem kind of funny. But you've said they were intended to be funny in some ways, or at least they would have been funny 500 years ago.
Well, I think the one right across from that creature, he's still there on the hell panel of the Garden of Delights.
Right.
There is a naked guy lying under a hybrid musical instrument, and on his ass is musical notation, and it's being sung by people who are standing beside him. Now, that image actually was taken over by the American artist Robert Gober, and he created a three-dimensional image of that ass with that music, which he thought was funny, and I'm sure that Bosch's audience thought it was funny too. that there's a lot of that kind of bathroom humor in art, in language, lots of expressions in the Middle Dutch of Bosch's time contained references to farting and shitting and to the ass and to all kinds of other bodily processes.
I wonder, it made me wonder if, and I didn't see a reference to this in your book, but Terry Gilliam, his cartoons for Monty Python, they seem absolutely influenced by Hieronymus Bosch. Certainly there were lots of people blowing horns out of their butts in his stuff, and I thought, gosh, that has to have been Bosch.
Oh, I would be delighted to learn that it was so.
Yeah. Let's. I wanted to ask you about what the people of the time made of this. Then, so he wasn't seen as. I mean, for example, there's that image that the if we're still looking at the hell side of the Garden of Delights, right below that creature who's devouring the. Person is a pig dressed like a nun.
Yes.
Now what? And maybe you can even describe the creature next to that. But start with the nun. What wouldn't that have been perceived as blasphemous in some way, or was this some kind of critique of the church?
Yes, it would have been seen as critique, like the other painting, the other triptych in which it's most closely related, the Heywain, in which you see prelates, even the Pope, and priests behaving in completely reprehensible ways, pursuing their own gain, trying to hoard money and goods. And here you see the pig with a monk's cowl kissing one of the damned souls after sexual fulfillment. Part of the monastic life throughout the Middle Ages and even to this day, I don't have to cite the particulars, has to do with sexual abuse, of making misuse of your authority, of the apparent sanctity in which you lived for lascivious purposes. So it was a part of the church's criticism of itself to attack and criticize those who indulged in these habits. So that nun in pig's form was part of churchly practice and not of heresy.
Because this was the era of Inquisition. So yes. I would have gotten a sense that there would have been a kind of intolerance of any kind of critique of the church of the time.
Well, after his death, there were rumors that Bosch might have indulged in heresy in some form or another, but this is immediately contradicted by. So the passage in which this is said is, some people say that Bosch was a heretic, but I say he wasn't. And so it was a kind of statement there. You assume, you know, there's more behind it than a man is letting on. The Inquisition wasn't active in the area that Bosch lived in, and its premises weren't accepted everywhere.
You have a favorite?
There was another. A famous manual for the combat of witches that came out right in the middle of Bosch's world, the Hammer of Witches, the Maleus Maleficarum. And this was written by two German Dominicans who got the Pope to actually approve a campaign against witches, but the Pope didn't go after it really with conviction. There was still a lot of skepticism about beliefs in witches.
It raises a question I wanted to ask you about. So he was an exorcist. disciples. Mm. I mean, he didn't perform exorcisms necessarily, but he was called by the church an exorcist. And you've said that would have meant something to him, and I'm not quite sure what that is. What is that?
I'm glad you mentioned this. I mentioned the minor orders of the clergy, and those were the gatekeeper, the reader, the exorcist, and the acolyte. So if you were invested with those orders, you could call yourself by those titles. They didn't have any real function. And indeed, if you were after a genuine exorcism, only a priest could perform it. But if you're a painter like Bosch and you're working on devils, demons, witches, and also creatures that are inhabiting you in spirit, and you had the title of exorcist, it must have meant more to him than it did to another of those lay members of the Brotherhood who also were called exorcists. To them, it would be an empty title. For him, I'm sure it had meaning. Yeah. But in saying I'm sure, you know that it's a speculation on my account. I'm very disappointed that my colleagues haven't picked up on this and thanked me for pointing it out. In fact, no one seems to believe it.
Yeah. Devils and demons, those things would have been very real. I mean, this is one of the things you write about, that people, you say for Christians of that time, life on earth was just kind of this short part of a larger journey, and that people thought a lot about the judgment. I guess they thought a lot about a devil figure and demons. I mean, these things were fairly real for these people, I suppose.
Yes, just as we are sure that we're going to die, what happens after death was just as real to people at the time. And what happened after death was eternity, which is a terrible, terrible concept if you think about it. I get dizzy thinking about the size of the universe. I can't stand it when the astronomers go on talking about billions and billions of stars in our galaxy and then billions and billions of galaxies. I get dizzy. Well, when you talk about eternity, the same kind of frenzy, horror takes hold of you. And then when images like these are presented to you and you're told this is something that you are going to endure forever and ever without any chance of ever escaping, I'm sure it hit people very hard.
The art historian Gary Schwartz is with us. His book is called Hieronymus Bosch, The Road to Heaven and Hell. We need to take another quick break. We'll come back for some final thoughts in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KEWR. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the art historian Gary Schwartz. We're talking about Hieronymus Bosch's book, Hieronymus Bosch, or Hieronymus Bosch, The Road to Heaven and Hell. He's joining us from a studio today in Amsterdam. I wanted to ask you, one of the things that you have said was that his illusions don't lend themselves to be deciphered. So how do you recommend people look at these paintings? Our producer, Ben, came in and he said, you know, it's so fascinating to just take a piece, a section, a subsection, and just dig in and look at the detail and then move to another section and look at the detail and all the weird creatures and all the strange things that are happening. So how do you recommend people see it? Not try to make sense of it too much, just take it in?
I think that they talked about it. I think that they were conversation pieces. These paintings were not closed in the private homes of people who had them to themselves. They would hang in churches, in palaces, in places where they would be observed by a variety of viewers. And if you see something like especially the central panel of the Garden of Earthly Delights, you would stand in front of it. And this is the way my colleague Reinhard Falkenberg has interpreted it, and talk about it. each of the members of the audience bringing into it their own particular background, knowledge, interests, and inclinations. And so it would open up a world of discourse. Now, he compared this to the way people read books in the court of the Nassaus and the rulers of the kind of the Low Countries in Bosch's time. And we know that they did engage in group readings and group discussions. And this is a very appealing idea to me as well. So one viewer would be a biblical scholar. He would remark, say the way I did, that this looks a lot like the passage in Genesis 1 that says, be fruitful and multiply. Mm-hmm. And there they are, being fruitful and multiplying all over the place. And another would be familiar with the court displays of wonders, a kind of prestidigitation and circus events taking place in the banquets of the court. And they would see reminiscences in the painting of that. Mm. And so it would go on, and it would take shape in the discourse of the viewer.
Head over to our Facebook page, by the way, and you can see an image of a painting that I want to ask Gary Schwartz about. It's called Extracting the Stone. Let's talk about this one, because you say in some ways this is maybe Bolse's most fun painting. And a lot of people have seen it as kind of a spoof, but you say there's also another interpretation. Tell us what it is first. Maybe describe it.
Well, there is a patient sitting in a chair with his head bent backwards, and into the crown of his skull, a figure with a funnel upside down on his head and a long cloak is pulling out a flower.
Right.
Yeah. Standing next to him is a monk with a jug in his hand, and at a table looking on with her chin in her hand is a woman with a book on her head. And this is taking place in a landscape. But there's a text written in gorgeous gold letters above and below the image, which is in a roundel, and this says, Sne de kai ras, meine nam is Libertas. Master, please take out the stone. My name is Libertas. And immediately there is a contradiction in the terms of the image and the text itself. It's talking about removing a stone, whereas the creature is removing a flower. Now, everyone, all my colleagues, see this as a pure spoof in which the man, the patient, is being made fun of, somebody who thinks that what's wrong with him, maybe mentally, is a stone in his head, which if he has it removed will turn him back into normalcy. And I interpret it in a different way. I see the figure standing behind him as an image of the medical world. I see the monk as an image of the church, and the woman with the book on her head as an image of the university. And all of them are trying to help this poor patient, and all of them are failing. So I give it a little bit of wider context. And again, it's one of my disappointments in scholarship that nobody seems to agree with me.
There's another terrific painting, a triptych, The Temptation of Saint Anthony. That was his favorite saint. And I want to ask you about one particular image, although there are like 70 in there we could probably work through. But this is the image of a skating bird with a letter in its beak, and it has this, looks like an oil funnel on it. There are a lot of these images.
Yeah.
This oil funnel thing appears. That's in the stone one, too. Anyway, what do you make of that? He's got this letter in his beak.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm looking at the picture, and the funnel has a little twig coming out of it atop, and there's a ball hanging from one of the branches of the twig. So, I mean, this is why I think Bosch is not really out to produce symbols or images that are capable of simple interpretation. And I doubt the usual school of interpretations, which relates these images to sayings in Middle Dutch or to passages in literature. I can't imagine that anyone of his time could have looked at a painting like the Triptych of St. Anthony and have come up with the kinds of explanations that scholars these days are doing. Anyway, so I don't think it's out to be deciphered in that way. There he is skating along with these wooden ice skates, with these big flaps coming out of his over his ears, and that letter in his beak. His beak is not very functional because the two parts of it don't really come together. The letter is actually draped over one of his beaks. It sticks through it. Now, it has been read, the letters on that that document, which is sealed, there's a red wax seal on it, as Proteo. They say it's an abbreviation of Protestatio, identifying it as a letter of protest or objection or accusation. Well, okay, this is one of the wonderful opportunities that this artist opens up for us, to let us exercise our own imaginations, especially if you're a scholar who knows so much about Middle Dutch and the time, and come up with these marvelous, unprovable interpretations.
We're essentially out of time, but let me ask you, less than a minute left. 500 years now since he died in August of, 500 years ago. I'm trying to think of the date offhand. What was it, 1516?
The 9th of August. It was this month.
Yeah, this month.
Yeah.
So how do you recommend people take in Bosch's work? Just look and enjoy, I suppose.
Absolutely. Just dive in and let your own, turn your own imaginations loose.
Gary Schwartz. His new book is Hieronymus Bosch, The Road to Heaven and Hell. Joined us from a studio in Amsterdam. Gary Schwartz, thank you very much for taking the time. That was fun.
Thank you, Doug. I really enjoyed our talk.
Go to the Facebook page of Radio West. You can see some of these images in really high resolution. They're great. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.